Welcome, everyone. And so I'm sure everyone's wondering what the mitzvah is, right? And we've been looking for it for over 1,000 years, and we think we've discovered it. And the goal for the next 40 minutes or so is going to be to kind of trace this journey that different people throughout different periods of the Jewish people have gone on to uncover this mitzvah. And the mitzvah is Tchelet. So, as we know, the Torah tells us at the end of Parashat Shlach, "Daber b'nei Yisrael v'amarta lehem v'asu lehem tzitzit al kanfei b'gdehem l'dorotam v'natnu al tzitzit hakanaf til tchelet." Right? There has to be a strand of tchelet on the tzitzis, on each and every corner. And this is, it's not only on tzitzis. Tchelet actually appears earlier in the Torah. It appears in the context of the building of the Mishkan. And it's used, it's one of the materials used to build, to construct the Mishkan, the curtains, and also the Big Day Kahuna. This is an image, actually, you can go today, if anyone's been to the Old City, they have a place that's called Machon HaMikdash. And it's kind of up the steps in the Rova, in the Jewish quarter, and they have it, the Temple Institute. And there they've been constructing some of the kalim, some of the vessels, some of the Big Day Kahuna, some of the clothes, And they're preparing for the building of the Beit HaMikdash, the third Beit HaMikdash, from here b'yameinu, and they want to have things ready to go. So there's a menorah that you could see. I'm sure you've seen it. It's huge. It's about like that big. It's gold, pure gold. And if you go in, they have different kalim, different vessels that were used. And they have actually a set of clothes for the Kohen Gadol, which the Kohen Gadol had like an apron here, and this was entirely made of tcheles. And this, can't see, but the choshen was made of different threads twined together. One of those threads was also tchelet. But that's only relevant if you're the Kohen Gadol, maybe if you're a Kohen also. But if you're a regular Jew, the only place you encountered tchelet was on your tzitzit. And what's unique about tchelet? Why was this special color chosen? So the Gemara, the first source here, quotes the Gemara, which says the following. It's famous because Rashi on the Torah quotes it. It says, Hayah Reb Meir Omer, Reb Meir said, why is tchelet different than all other colors that it was selected to be worn on everyone's tzitzit? Because the color of the tchelet is similar to that of the sea, which reflects that color of the sky, which reflects the color of the kisei hakavod, and it brings a pasuk to prove that. So the color is supposed to remind us, when we see this color, we're supposed to remind us of the Kisei HaKavod, of the heavenly throne, and we're supposed to think of God. It's supposed to enhance the general mitzvah of tzitzit, which is to remind us of the mitzvot in general, and specifically to focus on God. There are other things that that later commentaries have suggested, differences between the contrast between the white and the blue, and different ideas that they're supposed to remind us of. Now, the Jewish people weren't the only people that had tchelet. Tchelet was actually very common, or not. It was common, it wasn't very popular, because it was very expensive. Tchelet is very rare. Most people, synthetic dyes weren't discovered for hundreds of years. So your clothing was usually whatever color the natural material was. So if you wore linen or wool, it was kind of like a beige-ish off-white. And that was everyone's clothes. I look around the room, I see blues and oranges and reds and purples and all sorts of different colors, right? But if you would go back in time, 2,000 years, 3,000 years, people just wore beige because that was the only color available. It was very, very rare and expensive to get your hand on dyes. Dye material came from usually living organisms like snails. This is documented by Aristotle and Pliny the Elder in some of their accounts of the natural world. So they speak about the dyeing industry, and it was very, very difficult and expensive. You had to farm these snails, you had to hunt for them, you had to pull them out of the ocean, extract the dye, produce the dye, and it took a long time. So usually the only people that wore colors were royalty. Royalty, the kings, they had the rulers, they're the ones that had access to the colors, everyone else had no colors. And it's very typical of Judaism to take our best commodities and direct them to the service of God. That's something we do even today, right? We reserve our finest clothes for Shabbos, for Yom Tov, right? We reserve the best for God, so to speak. And that's why, in addition to the gold and the silver that were used in the production of the Mishkan and the Beit HaMikdash, we also use fine colored materials. Right? Tchelet, argaman is like a purple. There were specific colors that were meant to contrast the rest of the world, what everyone else was wearing. And symbolically, perhaps, the reason that every Jew had to wear it, couldn't afford, you know, a full blue garment for everyone, so the reason that people wore blue, one blue thread, was kind of symbolic of the fact that every Jew is quasi-royalty, because we're selected by God, we're God's people. And this is how the Jewish people observed the mitzvah of tzitzis for hundreds and hundreds of years. It was rare, it was expensive, it was difficult to get a hold of. Sometimes you couldn't afford it, you couldn't get a hold of it. But for hundreds of years, people observed the mitzvah in that way. Actually, today, before we move on to when we lost it, they've uncovered in Dor, which is in the northern coast of Israel, they've uncovered, archaeologists have uncovered kind of a whole factory or a whole plant where they would produce tchelet. And the shell, the snail that is used for tchelet, is called the chilazon. And it's available, you can find it off the coast of Israel. And they've uncovered places where they would hunt for them, they would gather them, they would store them, they would crack them. They found not only all the plants and all the different areas where they would produce the tchelet, but they've also found thousands and thousands and thousands of shells. And so we know that snail dye, was being produced off the northern coast of Israel. This was discovered mid-20th century. Still being uncovered today a little bit, and obviously sometimes you uncover things, you have to figure out, well, what exact dye were they using it for? That's where some of the controversy comes in. But we've actually uncovered areas where they were producing this dye in Israel. Now you fast forward to the year 68, and the second Beis HaMikdash is destroyed by the Romans. We usually say 70, I think it's usually assumed to be exactly 68, but somewhere around that time. And the Jewish people are exiled out of Yerushalayim. They still stay in Israel, they move to the north, they move to Yavne, they move around, but they're still in Israel until mid-second century, after the Bar Kokhba rebellion. Most of the Jewish people leave, they head to Bavel. And that's where the center for Judaism really moves. You have Sura, Pumbedisa, you have big Talmudic centers. I mean, that's where the Talmud is. The Gemara that we have comes from Bavel, Talmud Bavli, and it's produced there because that's where everyone moved. Now, you still had people living under Roman rule in Israel, but in smaller communities. However, the dye industry was still active, and these are coins from that time period, Roman coins, and on them they actually depict, can't see so well here, but this is a snail shell. And this is one of the legends in terms of how it was discovered. Hercules had a dog that discovered the shell for dyeing, so that's Hercules' dog discovering the shell. And this is also a Roman coin with this snail shell depicted under the coin. And there were other such coins, because the dye industry was very, very lucrative. So even though the Romans were making many decrees that made it difficult for the Jewish people to live under their rule, they were happy to let the dye industry keep going because it was a moneymaker. And you had Jewish people still producing the tchelet dye. Wasn't available in Bavel, but it was available in Israel, and the rabbis in Bavel used to import it. That was the way you wore your tchelet in Bavel, was if you imported it from Israel. And so the Gemara in Menachot tells us...
Was the Roman royalty using it?
Roman royalty was absolutely using it.
Oh, okay.
But it's interesting, we don't have knowledge of any decree that that no one else could wear it. There were later decrees like that only royalty could wear the colors. But under the Roman rule, the import-export trade was okay, because presumably they were still collecting taxes and different, you know, it was still in their interest to let the business keep going. So the Gemara in Menachot tells us, Amar le Abaye, this is the second source, le Rav Shmuel bar Rav Yehuda. Abaye is living in the 3rd century or early 4th century in Bavel, and he's interacting here with an Amora, a rabbi from the Talmudic period, who came from Israel to visit Bavel. There was communication and travel back and forth. And Abaye asks him a question. Hatchilta hechitzavitula. How do you produce the tchelet dye? Which means that in Israel they're still producing it. Right? And he tells him, Maitinan dam chilazon, we take the blood of the chilazon, the specific snail, v'samanim verminile biura. We take some other ingredients and we mix them all in a pot and we produce it. And it goes on, it's a little bit of a vague description, so that's going to be one of the challenges in rediscovering it, is rediscovering the exact process to produce the color. But nonetheless, we have evidence that in the time of Abaye, they're still producing it. Not only that, But the Gemara isn't redacted, it's not fully edited, until around the year 500. And the editors did not insert a comment in this Gemara saying, well, we no longer have it. There's no comment there. So scholars assume that that's further evidence that even in the year 500, when the Gemara is finally redacted, edited, we still have Tcheles. Unlike, let's say, if you fast forward 250 years to around the year 750, where you have the Medrash Tanchuma, which is a compilation of Midrashim, a very common compilation of Midrashim, very popular. But in there it says, next source, Mitzvah Lahavilavan Utchelet V'yaseh. The Mitzvah of Tzitzit is to bring white and blue and put them together on your strings. Ematai, when is that? Kishi Yetchelet. That's only when the Tchelet dye is available. The Akshav Ein Lanu El Lavan, Shatchelet Nignaz Mitzvah V'lavan. He says, nowadays we no longer have Tchelet. It's gone, it's been hidden from us. And therefore, we only have white. And that's why, sometime between the year 500 and 750, we lose Tchelet, the dye industry goes under, Jewish people no longer are producing it, it's no longer available, and Jewish people only have white strings available to them. And this is the way Tzitzis looked, really, largely till today. Now, exactly when it was lost is the subject of a debate. Rabbi Chaim Twersky from Lincolnwood, from Beis Chaim David, so he has an excellent article on this topic, and he just says the best estimate is that the loss of technology, the Tchelet dyeing process, and or the identity of the Chila zone, because once you stopped having Jewish people producing the dye, so presumably one or two generations later, the whole process of how to do it will disappear, because no one's passing on that information anymore. No one's identifying, this is the snail, this is what it looks like. And so he says, he gives two suggestions. Either a consequence of the Arab conquest of 639, or the result of Christian massacres in 628. So sometime in that area, in that time period, we lose the Tcheles completely. And it's gone. And Jewish people are just going on wearing tzitzis the way they do, with just white. Because the Yes.
Is the Filazon and Tolat Shani the same thing or not?
No, Tolat Shani is, which is one of the other threads that is used in the Mishkan, is red. Yeah. Tolat Shani is red. The next chapter doesn't come about until the 19th century. A very, very long time where no one really has the ability, the capability, or the interest, or even the knowledge to pursue the identification of the chila zone, the procedure to make tchelet. People have no idea. Not only that, not just in the Jewish community, but in the world at large, snail dyeing has all but disappeared. No one dyes from snails anymore. It's inefficient. We can produce dyes from plants much easier. And eventually people discover synthetic dyes. That's a little layer. Most of our clothes today comes from synthetic dyes. It's so inefficient to produce dye from a snail. You know how many snails you need to produce? To produce, let's say, four threads takes about 40 snails. I'm saying four threads for tzitzis. That's nothing. To make a shirt is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, not thousands of snails. Completely inefficient. So no one even has the desire to rediscover this process. And it probably would not have been even thought of if not for a particular French zoologist. I apologize if I'm not pronouncing his name right, but his name is Henri de la Case Duthier. And he's a French zoologist. He's living in the first half of the 19th century. And he's traveling, trying to study marine life, different fish life, different, you know, ocean life. And one day he notices that there was a fisherman. And the fisherman, just a simple guy, says, "Do you want to see something interesting?" Sure, you know, he's a zoologist, he's interested in nature, different things. The guy reaches down in the water, pulls out a snail, crushes the snail in his hand, rubs the goo, guts, whatever, on his shirt, and he watches as this fisherman's shirt, originally was just kind of a clear goo, turns yellow, and then it turns green, and eventually turns purple. He says, "That's amazing. That's really cool. If you're a zoologist, you're interested in the science, you're thinking, wow, that is really interesting. For hundreds of years, people were aware that such dyeing existed because it was written of by Pliny, by Aristotle. People were aware of it, but no one ever thought about it. And all of a sudden, he says, wow, that is really interesting. and he begins bringing the study of snail dyeing back into academic circles. Not long afterwards, in the late 19th century, a Hasidish Rebbe, we don't have a picture of him, but this is his seal, Hasidish Rebbe of Ritzin. His name is Rav Gershon Henoch Liner. And Rav Gershon Henoch Liner, he's a descendant from the Ishbitzer, who was a big Talmud of the Chozel Milublin. So a really important Hasidic dynasty. He was a radical. He was not a typical Hasidish Rebbe. He was always looking for different things. He studied science. He studied pharmacology. He was interested in all different things. And late 18th century, publishes a work in 1887. He says, it is no longer okay that the Jewish people don't fulfill the mitzvah of Tcheles. We need to go figure it out. We need to find the fish. We need to find the chilazon. We need to start producing Tcheles again. And so he writes his first book, Sfunei Tmunei Chol, which comes from a Gemara describing how the chilazon was hidden in the sand. And he says, we need to go and uncover this fish. These are the criteria. These are some of the things I'm going to look for. And this is why I think if I can find it, we should put it on again. We should wear it. And he goes through, I just brought a few examples of what are some of the criteria that the Gemara has for the chilazon. So for example, the Medrash in Shir Shirim Rabba refers to the chilazon. Amalei, tseyu lamadin ha-chilazon, shekol zmanchu gadel nartiko gadol limo. That while the chilazon grows, its nartik, its shell, grows along with it. The shell is growing. So, okay, I know I'm looking for something with a shell. Ultimately, we'll see the fish she identifies doesn't have a shell, but it has some type of cartilage. It's under its skin, but it's still something that is protective, and so he thinks that might suffice. Or he says, the Gemara in Shabbos says, Yugavam elu tzaydei chilazon misulamot shel tzor v'yad Haifa. It has to be found off the northern coast of Israel. It has to be found in that area. If the fish isn't there, can't be the chilazon. Or the Gemara in Megillah, which is where he gets his title, is Amar Zvulun Levnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the tribe of Zvulun complained to God, homiletically, Ribono Shel Olam, La'achina tata lehem sadot ukramim v'lina tata arim gvot. I don't understand. Everyone else has fields, vineyards, orchards. What do I have? I have mountains. I have nothing. La'achina tata lehem aratzot v'lina tata yamim v'naharot. I have rivers and oceans. So Amar Lo, Kulan tzrichin lecha ayadei chilazon. Everyone's going to need you to get the chilazon, because sfunei tmunachol, sfunei zeh chilazon. It sounds like they're hidden in the sand. So the fish you're finding, or the snail that you identify, has to burrow itself in the sand a little bit. If that's a snail, definitely happens. If it's the fish she identifies, not exactly buried in the sand, but perhaps buries itself in the ocean floor, we'll have to see. So the Ritzina Rebbe takes his son and one or two other people, and he heads off to... Where? No, he's not going to Israel. That would be a good place to go. That's not where he goes. If you want to go identify fish, where would you go? An aquarium. Right? Isn't that where you would go? He goes to the first aquarium that's open for the public. It's in Naples, Italy. And he's going to go and identify. He's going to go through all the fish, and he goes and he takes notes. And he's speaking to all the people who work there and saying, I'm looking for a fish. It fits this criteria. It fits that criteria. It could produce a dye. He's looking around. And he describes this in his second book. This is a ticket. This is what a ticket would look like to enter. And this is a drawing depicting the first aquarium. And his second book, he comes back. It's entitled Ptil Tchelet, The Strand of Tchelet. And in it, he describes his journey. He describes all the different fish he saw. And he says, I think I got it. Here's an excerpt from that book. And it says the following. And this is 1 year later. Ula Asher Ba'et Kihotzanu Ma'amamar. When I printed that first book, Adayin Lo Ra'inu Et HaChilazon Chai. I still hadn't seen, I hadn't identified which fish, which sea creature I'm looking for. I decided I'm going to go traveling. I'm going to go far. Italia, Beir, Napoli, Naples, Italy. There's the place where you can find all the sea creatures. They've gathered animals. There's also obviously a large zoo there. Jump down, he describes it. The next line, Vehu binyan gadol, it's a huge building, shalavanim, amkei haaretz, asfat yam hatichon, it's a huge building on the border of, on the shore. The way he's describing it, and I hadn't seen if this is exactly what it was, but if you go to a aquarium today, they just kind of have a big pool, and then you go under the pool and you look in the window. So I'm not sure if they had actually dug into the ocean. They put a room in the ocean, I think. That's what it looks like. And you're actually just seeing the ocean floor. You're standing next to the ocean floor. So I'm not sure if that was actually what it was, or it just looked like the ocean floor because they had built it in such a way. And he describes how he went with his son and they were looking. And in the next paragraph he says, I got it. Hakaya hazot shma sepia aficionala. A cuttlefish. It's kind of a squid. Looks like that. And that is the fish that the Radziner Rebbe says is the chilazim. It produces, yes?
Isn't it in a shell? It's not a fish.
Great. So he has to explain, and in the book he explains why he says, even though it doesn't have a shell, it has like a cartilage shell under its skin, and he thinks that suffices. So there are many, many, many questions on the... So I agree. There are many, many, many questions everyone has. But he publishes his book and says, this is the chilazon. Everyone knows squids have ink, right? It's like a defense mechanism. They cloud the water. So he took that ink, he brought it to chemists, and they worked together and they produced a blue dye. And he dyes strings blue, and he has tcheles. And he sends his book out to all the rabbis of the generation, saying, tell me what you think. Don't you think this is amazing? We have a third book from the Radziner Rebbe. It's called Ein Hatchela, and this is the longest book. Because in this book, you have all the correspondence, you have all the criticisms that the rabbis from around Europe and around the world sent to him, saying, listen, it doesn't have a shell, or other critiques, well, this is not so rare, it's not very expensive, the Gemara says it's very expensive, everyone knows about this fish, it's not very uncommon. People say, well, wait a second, one of the defining characteristics of tcheles is that it's very fast. It sticks strongly to your tzitzis. It never comes off. This dye comes out with soap. Many, many, many critiques of the Radziner Rebbe's tcheles. Ultimately, well, a minority of people did accept it. It was rejected. Most of the rabbis of the generation did not accept the Radziner Rebbe's tcheles. However, as Hasidim do. Hasidim obviously accepted the Radziner Rebbe's Tcheles. And so it's still available today. The Radziner Rebbe's Tcheles, and if you're a Radziner Chassid, you absolutely wear Tcheles. The Radziner Tcheles. Despite all the criticisms, it wasn't officially disproven until a few decades later. This is the first period, late 19th century, the first attempt to rediscover the chilazon. Attempt number two is as follows. Rav Yitzchak Halevi Herzog is born in Poland. As a young boy, moves to England. Yes, eventually he becomes the chief rabbi in 1937, 2 years after the passing of Rav Kook of pre-state Israel. And then he remains in that post until, I think, 58 or 59, the chief rabbi of Israel. And he is a world-class scholar. He has degrees in mathematics, in classics, in Oriental languages. He's brilliant. He's fluent in over seven languages. Really, really a scholar. And he is very interested in Tcheles. He's very interested in the Radziner Rebbe's dye. And he starts doing research for his doctorate on Tcheles. He even coins a term for the ancient dyeing, prophrenology. And he starts sending samples of tchelet out. He got the recipe from the Radziner Chassidim, takes it, and he starts sending it out to be analyzed by chemists. You know, what do you think of this? Is this real? Is it not real? Is it legitimate? Is it not legitimate? And so, he gets back some surprising letters. One excerpt, his dissertation is actually available. It's called The Royal Purple and the Biblical Blue. Was translated in public, well, it was written in English, but it was republished in book form by Ahab Spanier, who's someone who we'll encounter in a minute, but it is available. It looks like this. It's kind of expensive, but I thought it was worth owning. And he gets back a letter from one place that he sent a letter to, which is a dye manufacturer. And they said, according to your wishes, I have examined the sample of blue that you sent me. I don't know of any natural blue color other than indigo that is capable of solidly dyeing textiles and fibers. Right? Indigo, which will be very important momentarily, indigo is very fast. Indigo sticks well, but I'm not aware of any other naturally occurring colors. As far as the sepia is concerned, it yields brown and not blue dye. And that brown, furthermore, is not suitable for fixing on fiber. It doesn't stay very strong. It comes out with soap. The blue of the sample that you sent me exhibits all of the characteristics of Prussian blue obtained by processing salts of iron and potassium. Prussian blue is a blue that was discovered in 1704 by painters. They wanted to come up with blue, and the only blue they had up until then was available by a rock. It was very expensive and rare. And so they start using Prussian blue, which is a combination of different things, as mentioned here, salts and other things. But one of the key things you need is you need carbon. So where does carbon come from? Living things. We're all made up of carbon. So originally when they wanted to produce Prussian blue, they actually took blood from oxes. And they mixed it in. And all the other ingredients are white. So when the chemist showed the Radzina Rebbe this blue, he said, look, I take a colored substance, the dye, the ink from the cuttlefish, the sepia, and I mix it with all these white salts, and bam, you have blue. He didn't realize, the Radzina Rebbe, didn't realize that the dye was not unique. The dye isn't what made it blue. The ink from the sepia isn't what made it blue. Any carbon item would do. Blood would do. Anything would do to make it blue. There's nothing, presumably, Rav Herzog says, the chilazon has to be unique and particular in its qualities that it produces a specific dye. It can't be that any other organic material would suffice. And ultimately, he disproves Radzina Tcheles. This is seen as the death toll. Only the Chassidim still wear it, but no one else still wears it. And in a kind of a cute, not cute, but in a twist of fate, after the Holocaust, the Radzina dynasty was wiped out. The Radzina Rebbe's grandson was, there's different stories about how he was killed by the Nazis, and he was wrapped in his grandfather's talus, the first talus that was ever dyed with those blue strings, and he was killed by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam. And after the Holocaust, the Radzina Chassidim that were scattered around the world wanted to reopen this dyeing. But they didn't have the recipe. They didn't know how to do it. There's only one person in the world that had that recipe. It was Rav Herzog. And so they got in touch with Rav Herzog, and they said, Rav Herzog, can we have the recipe back because we would like to produce it? And he, of course, handed it over. Because there's an interesting halacha with tzitzis, and that is that even if tzitzis don't have to be white, there's a custom that they should be white. But really, tzitzis could be, the strings could be any color. You need tcheles, but the white strings could really be pink, purple, blue, orange, polka dot, it doesn't matter. So you don't lose anything by dyeing it Radziner blue, Prussian blue. There's nothing at loss. So therefore, he was happy to give it over, and Radziner Chassidim today still wear it. Now there was strong evidence for another sea creature. And Rav Herzog in his dissertation says, there's a lot of evidence pointing to this one creature. There's only one problem. The dye that, no, it wasn't extinct, but the dye that it produces is purple. So many secular scholars actually believed that real biblical Tcheles was purple. And the Jewish people, they think it's blue. They're wrong. They're wrong. When it says it's like the sky, so maybe it's like the sky at dusk, the sky is sometimes purplish, whatever. They were convinced that it's this snail. This snail was found in Israel. It was found in these archaeological digs. They decided it must have been purple and everyone got it wrong. However, Rav Herzog was not willing to accept it. Because the Gemara tells us, this is the final source, the Gemara says, Amar Rava, Lamali de'kada rachmana yitzia mitzrayim gabei tzitzis. Why is it that God juxtaposes the exodus from Egypt to the mitzvah of tzitzis? And the Gemara has a couple other mitzvot also why that God juxtaposes to. And the Gemara says the following, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because God said, Ani hu shehevchanti b'mitzrayim bein tipa shel b'chor l'tipa she'en shel b'chor. Just like I am God, who was able to differentiate in Egypt between who was the firstborn, who was the not firstborn. Only me, God, can tell you, especially in Egypt when everyone, all the family, everything was all mixed up. I was able to know. I can know the secrets. I know who's really the firstborn. So too, ani hu she'asad li para u'mimi she'tol l'kala ilan be'bigdo v'omer t'chilas hu. I'm going to know if you wear fake blue. Kala ilan. Kala ilan is translated as indigo. Indigo blue, the Gemara says, looks exactly like t'chilas, and someone might wear it knowingly, meaning if you don't know that you're wearing indigo and you think it's t'chilas, so that's not your fault. That's called ones. But let's say you know you're wearing indigo. Indigo is very cheap. It's easy to get. So I dye my strings indigo and I tell everyone, yeah, I'm wearing t'chilas. So God says, I'll know the difference and I'll ultimately exact punishment from that person. So Rav Herzog said, the Gemara is very clear that the color of t'chilas has to be the color of indigo. When you dye indigo, it looks something like that, which is blue. That's exactly what indigo looks like. Exactly. So that's why Rav Herzog was not willing to accept the secular scholars who said must be t'chilas was purple, because this other snail that there's archaeological evidence for, and Rav Herzog argues in favor of initially, they say it can't be, it must be t'chilas was purple. Rav Herzog not willing to accept it. So Rav Herzog does suggest another snail. Comes from the Janthia family. Looks something like that. Kind of a pretty looking snail, and it does produce blue dye. Rav Herzog never produces t'chilas from the snail, but he just kind of suggests it at the end of his dissertation. Fast forward to the 1980s, and you have a group of professors in Israel, and it's kind of a eclectic group, because you have archaeologists, and you have biologists, and chemists, and all sorts of different people that are still working on this problem. The problem of why can't we get this snail blue? This snail is known as the Murex trunculus. Murex trunculus. And this is the snail that they found thousands of in the archaeological digs in Dor. And this is the snail that Rav Herzog thinks is the best fit. Except for one small problem. It's purple. No one can figure out how are we going to get this thing to be not purple. So, you have this team. Sidney Adelstein, one professor. Ehud Spanier, another professor. He's the one who ultimately publishes Rav Herzog's dissertation. And Otto Elsner. He's a chemist. And Otto Elsner is at home and he's working on this problem. And he's mixing it and they figured out exactly how to mix, but every time it comes out purple. And there's an apocryphal story, but it's a cute story anyway, so we'll share it. And that he's working on this in his house. And his wife comes home and says, sweetie, it smells like rotting fish guts in this house. Can you please take it outside? Because what you're working with is, you take the snail, just to, okay, you kind of have to give it a little crack right over here, a little hammer and nail, and you give it a squeeze, and this gland comes out, and you have to just cut off that gland, and you throw it in a bowl, and eventually you just blend it all up. So, I'm sure everyone here has kind of had like a funky smelling piece of fish once or twice. Okay, so imagine you have a lot of that sitting in a bowl for like a couple hours in your house. It smells pretty bad. And so his wife says, can you please take that outside? And he takes it outside, and he comes back in an hour, and it's blue. The missing ingredient was sunlight. And there was no literature describing that you need sunlight, but it was obvious. Because 2,000 years ago, you didn't work indoors, you worked outdoors. It went without saying that it was going to be outdoors. So there's a little bit of a debate. Did that really happen, or was he thinking to test it with sunlight based on some other experiments? But either way, they finally discover the missing ingredient. Sunlight is what makes it blue. And you can either do it while you're still producing the dye, or even if you would produce the dye and then later put it in the sun, it would also turn blue, actually. And with that, they're able to produce dye.
What was his name?
Otto Elsner. And then, right after that, you have a rabbi in Israel, Rav Elio Tevgar, who writes a sefer defending t'chilas, and you have an American who had made aliyah. His name is Dr. Baruch Sturman. And the two of them begin mass producing it. Mass producing it, it was done in his garage, in Baruch Sturman's garage. Excuse me, they begin mass producing tcheles, selling it. I think they don't fish them off the coast of Israel. I'm not sure if the government doesn't want them to. They actually fish them in Spain, but they are found off the coast of Israel. You have to know how to get them. They're not easy to find. You have to go under the water. You need scuba gear, etc., etc., etc. Now, and they produce, they open a company. It's called Petil Tchelet. And they sell it. It's on the market. You might see some people in shul. Mm-hmm. I have it. And that's what it looks like. And it's amazing. It's now, there's still a major, major debate. We don't have time or to go through all the sources and all the particular Gemaras back and forth, and is it and isn't it, and how does it fit with that Gemara, and what about that opinion, etc. But needless to say, there's strong evidence, both halachic and certainly archaeological and scientific, that the Murex trunculus is the chilazon that's been lost for over a millennium.
Why is there a debate? That's it.
So it's a good question why there's a debate. The debate, so if you would speak to Rabbi Chaim Twersky from Lincolnwood, he would tell you it's 100% right. He would tell you he's 100%. He said when he first wrote his article 25 years ago, he thought it's probably right. He would tell you today it's 100% right. So some people are I would say, less convinced. For particular issues like ancillary. And some people say, even if it is right, we're not in a position to recreate any traditions, but certainly in Israel and even in America, many people are convinced. My Rebbe, Rabbi Herschel Schechter from YU, he's convinced that one should wear it, so he has a piece on it, and he wears tchelis openly. And there are many other people that, for certain reasons, they don't want to come out publicly and tell everyone to wear it. The people from Petil Tchelet told Rav Schechter that when they went to Rav Eliashiv and told him about Tchelet, so he asked them a question. He said, let me ask you, how much does it cost? So they said, well, you know, it costs about $70, let's say, for a pair. Well, they say, what would happen if 10,000 people went to buy it tomorrow? So they said, we can't produce it that fast. The price would go through the roof. So Rav Eliashiv said he didn't think that he can openly come out and support Tcheles because then the entire Haredi community would go and buy it, and these are families that can't afford food right now, and they're going to be spending, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars that they don't have just to fulfill this mitzvah.
So what do they use now?
They just wear white. They just go on wearing white.
The mitzvah says it has
open. Yeah, so the Gemara says that Tchelet is not ma'akev, which means you still fulfill the mitzvah of tzitzis even without blue, which is why for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years people have worn tzitzis without the blue. But the question is now that we have the opportunity, we have strong evidence that this is the long lost chilazon, so should we try and fulfill that mitzvah? Again, keep in mind we have nothing to lose. Because even if it's wrong, you still get the mitzvah, and you have a lot to gain by fulfilling the mitzvah of tchelet. So, you know, I found this story interesting. The story was recently documented in a little longer version in a book that Dr. Baruch Sturman and his wife put out recently. It's called The Rarest Blue. It's available at the Skokie Library also, or on Amazon, or in your local bookstore. And in it, he documents with much more detail a lot of this story and discovery. He's not getting into the halakhic debate of whether one should or shouldn't, although that is still an ongoing conversation, but it's just exciting to think about the opportunities that modern archaeology, science, technology afford us to fulfill potentially a mitzvah that has been lost for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Yes?
Can you take a minute to discuss why it's not the Akeh within the actual text?
So it's an excellent question. It's an explicit Mishnah in Masechet Menachot. And the general explanation is that Tchelet, while it is explicit in the Pasuk, it's considered to be ancillary to the primary mitzvah of, well, this itself is a debate. Is it that there are two separate mitzvahs, white and blue, let's say? One approach is there are two separate mitzvahs, white and blue. And the Mishnah says you could wear white without blue, you could wear blue without white. So either way it goes. Exactly, you're only fulfilling one mitzvah. The approach of the Rambam and others like him is that no. The real mitzvah is white. The blue is just a cherry on top. You know, it's an added detail to the mitzvah. It's a nicer way, a more complete way to fulfill the mitzvah. But even without it, you're still fulfilling the mitzvah. Even without without that added detail, even though the Torah.
And that was obviously that they said that before it was lost.
Yes, it's in the Mishnah. So that was even when they still had it.
Is that because of the uniqueness and the hardship of getting that dye that it makes it more prominent mitzvah, or I mean, it makes it more.
Meaning more flexible.
More special or greater mitzvah to have the groom?
Well, it's an interesting question. Certainly, the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot says lefum tzara agra, which means the amount of effort that you put into a mitzvah, you will be rewarded accordingly. Meaning, a mitzvah that you work harder for, you get a greater reward than a mitzvah that you work less hard for. But the flip side is also true. Meaning, the Gemara says that Hashem is going to punish someone who doesn't wear white much more than someone who doesn't wear blue. Tzitzis. Why? Because white, everyone can get. So you really don't have an excuse for not wearing it. When it comes to blue, sometimes you have an excuse. It's not available, you can't afford it. You're living in Bavel, and they only import it. It's not like now the mail system, you could overnight it, you know. So maybe the Tchelas dealer isn't coming to town for another few months, and you know, you don't have any blue string. So Hashem is more understanding, you know, with our inability to fulfill a mitzvah that is lost or unavailable to us, as opposed to a mitzvah that's right in front of us and you don't put it on. So on the one hand, Hashem is more willing to understand if you don't fulfill a mitzvah that's difficult. On the other hand, when you do fulfill a mitzvah that's difficult, it's a greater reward. Well, I think that's what I mentioned in the beginning. I think symbolically it's represented because we're called Mamlechet Kohanim. So all the Jewish people are kind of like quasi-Kohanim in the sense that we're teachers, we're meant to represent something to the rest of the world. So even myself, I wear a little blue. I don't wear a full garment of blue, you know, or even a full belt. Well, I wear a little blue to represent the fact that I'm like a quasi-Kohen. Mm-hmm.
So how about like, if someone, let's say, is not sure, right? Isn't it worse for them to... Like, we looked at that source where it said, like, Hashem, if you're wearing a fake one, Hashem judges you.
Right.
You know, so, like, let's say this isn't the right one, right?
So that's one argument against. This is one of many arguments against, which says, well, maybe you're wearing Kala Ilan, right? Maybe you're wearing the fake blue.
Isn't that worse than just wearing white, then?
Right, it's not worse. Right. But keep in mind, that's the Gemara is referring to someone who intentionally puts on fake blue and passes it off as real Tchelet. Myself, I'm not... intentionally putting on. Okay, I'm putting this on because I think it's the real tchelet. If it turns out, in God's eyes, God knows that it's not. So God will say, but I think I'm doing the proper thing. So, you know, it's kind of conditional, but so I don't lose anything because I don't think it definitely is.
Right.
You know.
As I recall, and I took the tour of the
yes.
That the Chila Zone used to come up to the shores of Israel once every 70 years. And so part of the, my understanding is part of the thing that people, that some rabbis have against it, is that they go out and get it instead of it coming in. And the reason why they go out and get it is because otherwise you have to wait once in every 70 years for it to come to the shore.
So,
and they could also show that there's a certain tide that came from a certain area that brought them up. Yeah, so
very good. The Gemara actually says that the Chilazon is, it comes up once every 70 years. So the Gemara describes it as that. Now, Rav Herzog in his dissertation already pointed out that we're not really aware of any living creature that acts in that way. What it means, 70 years, is kind of like a terminology that means once in a blue moon. You know, in English we say once in a blue moon. So there certainly are ways for the chilazon to come up, but as Rav Tversky told me, he said, you're right, it doesn't come up very often, and that's why you need to go get it. Now in the times of the Gemara, you couldn't go get it because you need scuba gear. Scuba gear, I can't tell you exactly when it was invented, but I think it was pretty recently. So you're right, but there's no halacha that you have to wait for it to come up. That Gemara is just describing actually why it's expensive. The Gemara says it's expensive because it's hard to identify, it only comes up every once in a while, and you have to go pretty far out, further underwater than they were able to go to get it. Now, Aristotle already describes trapping methods for it, meaning what you do is you put down a basket or a net or something, and you put some food in, and it takes a while because they are snails, but eventually they come to the food. And he actually has an interesting chapter in his book describing how they're actually carnivores and they eat other snails or each other sometimes. But that's you could read the book if you're more interested in that. But either way, it does take a while. But they would trap them using these baskets with bait in them. But again, all this just speaks to the rarity of it and the expense of it, and that's why it was very difficult then, and even today, with all the technology we have, still very expensive. Yes?
I missed it.
Yes.
So what are people about
here? Sure. These, apparently, I was asking Tversky, they're a little lighter than most, not because it faded, because it doesn't fade, but because they just didn't let it sit in the dye as long. but it does look like. Of course. Of course. I apologize. I should have brought my talus, because then I could have passed it around.
But it looks.
Yeah, it usually comes much darker.
They're all out of gray in that particular color.
They come more royal blue.
So that's another specific material.
It's more like sky blue. So I'll just touch on in literally 1 minute because I'm already over my time. But the halacha is that the other strings, the white strings, could be made of whatever material. The blue strings have to be made of wool. And this dye actually sticks to wool very strong, but if you put it on cotton, it actually doesn't stick so well. Which Rav Herzog actually was also upset. He said, the dye from the Murex doesn't stick well, but that's because he was dyeing it on cotton. But if you dye it on wool, it doesn't come out. You could soak this in a bleach combination, the dye won't come out. The other question is, how many strings? Right, we know you have four strings folded in half. Right? Since there's four strings folded over, so it's eight. So there's a debate, how many of the eight need to be? The Rambam says one of the eight, meaning only half of the four. Many Rishonim say one full string. Tosfot and Rashi say two full strings, which would be half blue, half white. I know. So the Gemara has a different drug. I'm not going to get into that, Machlokas Rishonim, but that's the Rambam's opinion, that it's one string. But my Rebbe Rav Shechter says Rashkenazim, we usually follow Tosfot, so that's why I'm stuck with that. And there's also a debate exactly how to tie it. Because the way the white strings are tied, it doesn't matter. Midor Raisa, on a biblical level, you get the mitzvah as long as you have one knot and some wraps. Wrappings and knot, you got the mitzvah. So exactly the more detailed way how to tie it, there are many different ways. There's the Rambam and the Ravid and the Sefer HaChinuch and the Vilna Gaon, and there's all sorts of different approaches how to tie it, because that was lost along with the Tehillah, and so you'll see different people tying it different ways. So either way, I hope this was just an interesting journey over a mitzvah that is making a comeback in the 21st century. Enjoy the rest of the day, everyone.